You are listening to The Night War, an audio companion. For more than 65 years, the Night War has taught us what it takes to fight a war, and what war takes from those who fight. Today is a special episode of the Audio Companion for two reasons. Liv?
Hey listeners, it's March 1944. Bucky turned 27 on March 10th.
That's right, so a very fond happy birthday to you, Uncle Bucky. And Liv, the other reason?
It's March 1944. I love this chapter.
Why is that?
Oh man. It's just the best. Like, it's my favorite. It's so romantic and it's exciting. Like, the commandos all sneaking around Nazi-occupied Paris, Genevieve. It's so cool. Oh, and the single best movie ever made about any of the commando missions, The Train. Le Train. It's so good.
Actually, that's related to one of the other questions we've received recently regarding movie recommendations. Let me see. The listener asks, there are many movie adaptations, and I was wondering if you thought there were any that were not complete and total shit. Not just direct adaptations of The Night War, but all the movies concerning the Howling Commandos or Captain America?
Well, I love The Train.
Tell us about it.
It's this great French movie made in, like, the 80s? And it's all about that crazy train mission that the commandos did in order to capture some dude. It's great. The movie is, like, mostly in black and white, except for a bunch of parts where they do things in blue and red and white, because, you know, it's the colors of the French flag and all that.
Okay, so that's The Train. Any others?
I like the episode of Band of Brothers with Bucky in it.
Because you're a glutton for punishment?
It's a good episode.
And the medic is cute.
I mean, you know, he is. His voice. Oh my god. Anyways, what about you then?
Well, the interesting thing about the question is that there's never actually been a true adaptation of The Night War. Aunt Becca and Uncle Ted were opposed to optioning the rights, even as recently as, I think, 2005 or so, just because of how complex a job it would be. And, of course, some of the other films that have been made have been pretty bad. I would say the worst is definitely...
Skull Hunter. Oh my god. Yeah. So bad.
Right. And I think the best is probably Hunter, with Harvey Keitel, mm-hmm. which was set during the Battle of the Bulge. It's a very difficult film to watch, but definitely the one that does the most justice to Bucky's experience and the isolation he felt as a sharpshooter.
So depressing.
It was. Auntie Becca, to this day, has only seen maybe half of it. Speaking of which, did you?
Yes, I did. So last time we talked to Frank Castellano about a bunch of things. But one of the questions we had for him was from a listener who wanted to know about the real Bucky Barnes. And so I talked to Auntie Becca about it. I tried to get her to come on podcast.
Not much luck.
Yeah, she said, don't be silly, Livy. And then she reminded me, where is it? Everybody thinks Bucky only wrote in his journal, but he wrote me stories in almost every letter he sent home. And he wrote me stories when I was a little girl, too. And she gave me a couple of his letters.
Oh, you mean his poems. So for the benefit of the audience, there are a few little silly poems we have in our family.
They're not silly. They're like...
Family traditions.
Yeah. Bucky wrote a lot of letters home, but specifically to Auntie Becca, he used to include a couple of stanzas of a poem story he was telling her, and they're all about this character, Dee Dee Sparrow.
Didn't you have a stuffed animal bird?
I think you mean have.
Oh, right, sorry. You have a stuffed animal bird.
Whatever, Mom. Anyways, yes, I have a Dee Dee Sparrow stuffed animal bird on my bed this very minute, and she comes from the letters Bucky used to write Auntie Becca.
And she gave you some.
Yeah, she gave me... Actually, she said that she used to have more, that there were other characters, or sometimes they'd be like, this whole story instead of, what's it called when you, when it's broken out over time?
Serialized?
Yeah.
Serialized?
Yes. So he used to do, like, standalone ones, and then starting with the Dee Dee Sparrow stuff, it was serialized. So this is the first one, actually, from January 1944. I'm just going to read it, okay?
Sure. Listener, hopefully this will help to answer your question. Who was the real Bucky Barnes?
So it's dated January 16, 1944. Dearest Curly, don't worry too much about me. I'd be concerned about Dee Dee. The first thing we must know is this. Dee Dee is a bird, a sparrow. Born and raised in Brooklyn Borough. A darling, funny, clever miss who plans to run away tomorrow. She will strike out on her lonesome. But why and how and where to go? The truth is that her dear bear beau, taken, stolen, held for ransom, as told her by the sharp-eyed crow. Her bear was once just a teddy, but in the night his eyes go bright, and beau, the bear, comes quite alive. At first this made her feel unsteady, but Dee Dee Sparrow knows no fright.
Love, your brother. March 1st. I am writing all these names down, and will fill in the last names once we are back in England, because by God, these people deserve to be remembered. Paul Bone, Marie-Françoise Fouillard, Marc Lemarié, Georges Metz, Jean-Vieff Marcel. They met us at the drop, two dames and four men, checked our clothing for anything incriminating. We are acting in a real British intelligence picture with this one. I don't know yet if I like it more than our usual mission, but so far it is more fun. They had their own bicycles as well, and we set off when it was still 1 a.m. London time. Jean-Vieff, who is the most beautiful woman I have ever seen, had two watches on her wrist, and she has very good English, so I asked why, and she showed them to me and said, Paris lives by Bosch time now, but I keep Paris time beside my heartbeat. And I liked the idea of that so much, I was seconds away from changing mine to Brooklyn time. Only, I don't have a second watch for Bosch time, and unfortunately, my life is set to Bosch time these days. Anyhow, we paddled for a few hours, and then said goodbye to Jones and Morta. Of course they can handle themselves, but I do hate to see our unit split up for even a second. They went with J.L. and P., while Mark led the way to a farmhouse, which is empty, and which they are using as a base of operations. We are still at least 40 kilos from Paris, but the plan is to take the train in like we are regular people tomorrow. We brought food with us on the drop, and Marie-Françoise had wine, and cooked with Georges' help, but not Dernier's, thank God, and we ate and drank together, this small army filled with purpose. Later Dugan noticed Genevieve writing in her own little notebook, and says, in his loud, drunk way, "A match made in heaven, Sarge." And of course she looks up and asks me if I am a writer too. What a laugh. But I tell her, I'm no Hemingway, but somehow all of this is easier if I can just write it down at the end of the day. She looks at me for a few long seconds after that, looking like Rita Hayworth's prettier sister with the fire beside her, lighting up her face, and finally says, I understand you. For me it is this. All Europe is imprisoned, and I can do my part, and come and go as I please. But for how long? The English, they have a writer, a woman, who said, lock up your libraries if you like, but there is no gate, no lock, no bolt that you can set upon the freedom of my mind. She shrugged her slender little shoulder, and then said, in writing about it, I am reminded that even if France today is travail, famille, patrie, and then she pulled back her coat sleeve and touched her wrist, the second watch, the watch for Paris, and said, my France remains liberté, égalité, fraternité. What a woman. March 3rd. I have seen some strange things in this war, but Paris, a place I have only ever seen pictures of, or seen that time I took Bertie Hager to see L'Atalanta, it seems like a faded version of itself, an old rug that has spent too long next to a window getting walked on. The sounds are like no other city I ever heard. No cars, except for German ones, driven by boys in uniform who look like they might be Curly's age if they're lucky. No color but the red and swastikas. And everywhere underfed people in layers of dark, threadbare clothes. The entire city filled with echoing clip-clops, as everybody goes about in shoes with wooden soles, since there hadn't been any leather in years, according to Mark. What a very strange place, especially when you think of how I always imagined it, back when I read The Hunchback of Notre Dame, and A Tale of Two Cities, and all of Dumas, and even The Scarlet Pimpernel. In any case, we got very lucky on a train. We all split across multiple cars, so it wouldn't look so strange to have a big group of young people all together. Especially young, able-bodied men, as it seems most of those have been forced into labor in Germany, including a brother of Marie-Françoise. Our papers held up fine. I guess the Brits really know what they're doing there. And the bandages we rigged up around Dugan's face made it so no one expected him to talk. He speaks the worst French anyone I ever heard. Me, I can at least get a few words right. So the least anyone thinks is I'm an immigrant, according to Georges. Genevieve got word from her sources that Mr. Chaplin is on schedule. He is going to be attending meetings at the Majestic, where the rest of the important krauts are, but our intelligence indicates he is staying at the Ritz with his mistress, and that the artifact we are looking for is either going to be there or on a train, but less likely the train on account of the Hydra krauts don't trust Goering. Either way, it is Jones and Morta's job to deal with the train. The rest of us are tasked with the Ritz. Lodging difficult here, because the police and the Gestapo have been merciless with the French resistance, especially as all the French know that soon the Allies are coming back. Steve and me are in a small apartment about half mile from the Ritz with Mark and Genevieve. Dugan and Dernier with George and M.F. at another apartment a few blocks away. The building was chosen because it has three exits, through the back garden and also up to the roof. And there is a secret knock so we know whoever comes to the door is safe, and another knock if they have been arrested and coerced by the krauts. Genevieve told me it used to be only one knock was needed, but enough people began getting betrayed that they had to come up with a new system. She told me, "I have been arrested. I understand the fear. It is that I am beautiful, and a woman, that I was lucky, and they pitied me, and did not hurt me very much, and I was freed after only a short time." She said it like it was nothing, but as someone who has also been captured, it is easy to see in her eyes that she is not so indifferent about it. Jesus, did not hurt me very much. It makes me raging mad to think of her, or any woman, in kraut hands. At least we are doing something about it. While it is terrible to see combat as much as we do, I think back of those awful days in the mud and rain and cold of Italy, of digging in again and again, gaining a few yards a day, and for what? It is hard to feel like that does anything to win the war. It is hard to feel like you are doing anything other than waiting miserably for your turn to either get blown up or mowed down by the fucking Hun buzzsaws. As awful as our lot is, theirs is no doubt worse for knowing that over each hill is another kraut line with another row of pillboxes, and behind that line, another line of the same, and another after that. It is enough to drive a man mad. Sometimes I think maybe I have gone mad, or that the whole world's gone mad together. Maybe that is a little more the truth of it. At any rate, here we are doing something. The flat where we are staying is very small and has been rented through the end of the month. Mark and Genevieve are both asleep, exhausted from last night and all the bicycling, and no doubt the stress. The strain of being on that train today, and even walking through the streets, was immense. I can't believe they've been at it for close to 3 years now, and so many of their friends and associates arrested or worse. I suppose it is very hard to get the news out, but if people back home had any idea what it has been like in France, I think they would be shocked. Mark said that he had been a part of a different circuit for some time that got infiltrated by the Gestapo, and nearly all of it got arrested, and it was sheer luck he was not also arrested. He has no idea what happened to any of his friends except for those he knows were shot. For Genevieve, I think her story must be worse. She was silent all throughout Mark's explanation, only speaking to help him with his English. I cannot decide if I want to know everything, or if I'm afraid of the tragedy of it. All his sorrow weighs on a man. Steve is sleeping. He only seems to need a little sleep now. Me, I sleep as little as he does, but it's only because I either can't fall asleep at all, or want nothing more than to wake up when I am asleep. I remember when it was restful. No greater feeling than finishing a double down at work and coming home to a cold beer in the icebox, and then 12 hours to lay in bed and listen to the Dodgers play on the radio, and it's so hot it feels like an oven inside, and the windows are open and everybody's trash and cooking oil seems overpowering, and the air is heavy and wet, and the whole city is lazy, hot, indolent, storm clouds in the distance. With your job done for the day and still sweating and stinking and nothing to do but lay there waiting for the rain, I can picture it exactly, and almost taste it. Funny how badly I long for those long, hot, miserable summer days. March 6th. Another day, and we are not found out or captured yet. Thank God for that. Yesterday, in small groups, we left the flat to do our part. In my case, I went with Genevieve, any chance I get, to an apartment building and boulangerie, not far from the Majestic, where there is a drop box that has been safe as houses for at least half a year, according to G. Incredible relief to get the message from Jim and Gabe that they are all right, and getting their bits set up along with the others. J.L. and Paul have organized rail workers and other partisans for the train part, and after hearing from Mark what kind of scrutiny the trains are under, frankly, Jim and Gabe's bravery astonishes me. All the newsreels and radio interviews are interested in Steve and Dugan and me, and it is a damn fucking shame, because to look like the two of them do and go behind enemy lines anyway is the kind of courage that, if the world survives all this, people will write books about one day. It is moments when I think of them that, just for a second, I feel a kind of pride to serve that all the USO shows and propaganda movies try to make regular folks think we soldiers have all the time. Not pissing yourself afraid waiting for the landing vehicle to reach waist-high water so you can rush the beach. Not praying to survive in a foxhole, or at least go painlessly. Not sitting in a tree killing people from 500 yards away. Who could be proud of any of that? But serving beside Jones and Morta, that is a kind of honor that's humbling. Today, spent surveilling. Reconnected with Steve and Monty and Dugan, and went to the spot Mark found, after confirming that his source in the Ritz put Herr Chaplin in the hotel room we asked for. Steve and me set up for a few hours observing, and this is possibly the best joke I've had, at least since Sicily, after the fighting was over. Herr Chaplin and his mistress were making time when I got Betsy set up to surveil them. Talk about something nobody wants to see. I acted like nothing was happening and then asked Steve to check the scope. He moved so fast away from the gun that he nearly blew our cover. He hadn't gone that red in years. I think if we hadn't been reconnoitering, he would have punched me. In any case, I haven't laughed that hard since I don't know when. Fortunately, the episode did not last long. Perhaps not so fortunate for Madame Chaplin, huh. And we got down to the work of locating our objective. Did not take long, since because, as we suspected, Chaplin did not bring it to the Majestic. Thank Christ. I'm brave enough for most things, but infiltrating high command is last on my list of things I want to be doing. After a while, Steve got antsy. Something no one could possibly be surprised at, looking at the last 26 years of Steve Rogers. He asked me, as I had Chaplin in my sights, "Do you think you could pull the trigger now?" I was surprised. We have never talked about it, but Steve is the most direct person there ever was, and I know him enough that he does not like to think too hard on what my part is in all of this. I asked him, "Is that an order?" And he yelped almost so loudly that I thought we might get spotted, "Jesus, Buck, no!" And gives me this wounded sort of look. Another Steve Rogers special. I don't know how somebody who's gone through life with as many knocks as him still thinks the world is, at heart, a fair and decent place. That is one of the reasons I never wanted him to go to war. It is so essential to him, and special, that for war to crush that would be a goddamn tragedy. But nobody ever stopped him when he had his mind set to something, did they? I ought to know. I just meant, do you think you could? If these long dark months I have spent at war have taught me anything, it is that nearly all men can do things more terrible and unnatural and awful than we ever thought we could. Battle has a way of stripping the civilization away from a person. It is a turpentine for decency. But it is one thing to shoot a man in combat, or even to vanguard an assault like in Greece. Laying flat on a Paris rooftop, sun going down, and everything blacked out but the dusk, just enough to let you see the outline of it all. This place where I think it was Thomas Jefferson, or maybe John Adams, who said that going to Paris will teach you history, beauty, and the meaning of life. And yet when I go to Paris, I got a gun in my hand, and Steve wants to know if I could shoot a man in cold blood, even if he is the enemy. I didn't think all that when Steve asked me. Not in so many words. I think some of it is just in your gut, pictures and feelings. And if I write it down, I can put it into words, a little. I said, I don't want to, but I could. He looked sad, but he didn't say anything. Since when do we brothers need words? But lit a smoke and gave me half. March 9th. The day after next is the day. Everything is set. Our source in the Ritz has confirmed Chaplin is going to the Majestic for another set of meetings, and his mistress is going to the pictures and lunch with other Kraut wives. The riskiest part of it all is switching the driver at the Majestic to Dernier for when he comes back. I think Dernier would rather gouge out his own eyes than say he is a French policeman, even if it's part of a mission. We will have about 3 hours to go through the hotel room, and then get to Gare du Nord and on the train, before Dernier brings Chaplin to the station also. If all goes according to plan, by this time 2 days from now, the train will have been sabotaged with no survivors, and we will be on a plane with Chaplin and his artifact back to London. Genevieve and MF are as cool as Agent Carter. They've been bicycling all over Paris today, helping to coordinate the rail worker part. G putting herself at real risk, especially because she has already been arrested once, and with everything going so poorly in the East, and everyone knowing the Allies will soon be invading, I guess all of France is getting riled up against Les Boches. And they know it, too. Today she was even stopped by a policeman. Obviously she was fine, as she told us this just a few hours ago. But imagine if it had been a Gestapo instead of a French. Anyway, the copper said to her, Je vous connais. Du Paris vous connais. Vous êtes le héron bleu. It means, I know you. All of Paris knows you. You are the blue heron. When she was telling us, her voice shook a little. I guess when she was first arrested, she found out that the police called her that in their notes and spying, the Blue Heron, because they didn't know her name yet, and that is how they described her. A tall woman in a blue coat. A blue coat that is now threadbare, but still blue, if faded. And as tough as a woman wearing it. But he let her go. She said to him only 3 words. Le Heron, pensez. And he stepped back and turned away. Imagine if he had not. Imagine if she were back in 84 Avenue Foch because of helping us. I will never forgive myself. What amazing courage she has. March 10th. It is late, or I suppose very early. Everyone trying to rest, although I doubt anyone is sleeping well. I am not even trying. We are so close to the trap here, so near to the teeth. And if anything should go wrong, then all of us will be dead at best and captured at worst. G came to me with a bottle of wine. Somehow the French still have wine, and poured 2 glasses without saying a word. It was 3:30, too late and too early to drink, but in war you break all kinds of rules, including sleeping at reasonable hours, which I have not done since probably the day we began to fight at Sicily. She did not say anything right away except, Bon anniversaire. And I know enough French now to figure out she was wishing me a happy birthday. I guess I looked suspicious at her because she smiled at me, an innocent sort of smile, not the kind where it is from relief that the mission did not end in tragedy, or that at least there was enough food to eat for tonight, but the kind of smile where it is purely for the sake of having surprised somebody on something small. Capitaine d'Amérique, she explained with her usual amused little laugh. Of course, as Steve had told her, no doubt he's tickled pink seeing me with hearts in my eyes over this woman. I told her she was a couple hours early. Truth is, after so long of everything being awful, and your life being so entirely different than anything you knew before, or ever expected, something as little as a birthday seems frankly strange, like a bubble of happy past that has risen to the top of your heart and burst, just when you least expect it. A birthday, here. Who thought there could even be birthdays anymore? I know, she said, it is not yet your birthday in New York. Accent so much stronger than normal, I think, because she was tired. It gives a man thoughts. She tapped her Paris watch. But we make the best we can. No flour, sugar, milk, or eggs for cake. Pardon, Mais un peu de vin for the man turning. Vast up. Nothing like meeting the world's most perfect woman to make a fellow practice his French. She teased me with a smile. L'homme âgé. I find myself memorizing these smiles of hers and filing them away. Like maybe one day months from now I can unfold it in my mind. Like I might a letter from home be transported back. Geneviève is only 22, but as with everyone in Europe, that hardly matters. We have all seen enough of life to be âgé together. After a bit of drinking quietly, she then asked, If you are home, what are you doing? And I told her I didn't know, but would rather not imagine it. As if everything were the same except I was home, and both my brothers would still be away, and Steve and the others still here. She scolded me for being too literal, and then said, This day next year, how do you imagine it? The truth is, and I think every infantryman knows this in his heart, that it is dangerous to think so far ahead. Much more dangerous than thinking of the past. At first everyone does, you can't help it. And there does come a time when you go from thinking about what you'll do when you get out of the army, and all the food you'll eat, dames you'll dance with, movies you'll see, places you'll go, to wondering how any of that could ever come to pass knowing what you know now. That's the problem, I think, is that when I long for home, it's not that I long for Brooklyn now, although I do. It's more that I long for who I was then. I miss life before all this. And it's worse for knowing that you can't go back. It's impossible to go back. I think I would have liked her to know the guy I used to be. But none of this is something she doesn't already know. We all know it. So I thought for a minute and said, The war's over, and Jack and Teddy never had to fight at all. The commandos all made it home, and by then Steve has married his best girl, and maybe soon I'll even get to be Uncle Bucky. And my mom and kid sister make me a cake, and my dad gives me a book, maybe an Agatha Christie, because of how we both like mysteries. And he probably will already have read it and written his guesses in pencil in the margins. And then Steve and me take our best girls out dancing, Steve, his wife, and me. I smiled at her. And for a little second, maybe not even a second, it was like we were two regular people, and her simply a gorgeous dame embarrassed about getting flirted with. To next year, she said, after blushing a little, raising her glass, which was almost empty. À l'année prochaine. Marcel? Shit. You get an early start on a communion wine, Sarge?
No, I... sorry.
Hell if I care. You want a drink, you drink. What's the occasion?
It's... It was just... this.
Read nothing and drive me to the bottle, too. Listen, I'm going to mass and then lunch with a bunch of old farts. You good? You need anything?
I'm good.
All right, then.